Hi, I'm Christine, and I just took a tour of the Thompson Center. You're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. We're saving the atrium of the Thompson Center. How about that? Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. And what we do here on show number 896 is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is usually our engineer on duty in the WGN radio studio. He's off today. Bob Fukuda is filling in. So thanks to Bob for all of his help in the studio. And look, we all love a good time, right? Of course we do. Now, my idea of a fun experience might be a little different from yours, and that's okay. What is not my idea of fun is driving my car in circles over and over again in the middle of a Chicago intersection at about 2 a.m., screeching my tires and just gunning my engine. But I'm not other people, and some folks do this activity fairly regularly. It's called a street takeover, and it can generate a crowd of onlookers, roughly about 150 to 200 people, and these street takeovers happen in the middle of the night. Now, this is a problem if you're a resident of one of the areas where these street takeovers are going on. Loud engines and screeching tires in the middle of the night don't bode well for a good night's sleep. The Sun-Times ran an article about street takeovers earlier in the week. The story quoted a resident of the McKinley Park neighborhood. She said that she calls the police when these events happen, and then the cops show up, and then the crowds disperse, but they reform later on, sometimes just a few hours later. This resident said, quote, "It's to the point I recognize specific 911 operators' voices. It's ridiculous. I hate that this has become a reality," end quote. The city has tried to curb these street takeovers by passing an ordinance in July of 2022 that gave authority to the police to impound vehicles who participate in these events, but that doesn't seem to be incredibly effective. The alderperson of the 12th Ward, where some of these takeovers are happening, Julia Ramirez, has tried to set up a meeting with the police about what's going on, but so far that has not materialized. Look, if you really want to drive your cars in circles, burn rubber, and rev your engines, maybe the city could step in and provide a safe space for you to do just that. Chicago owns a lot of property, and some of that property contains areas of vacant lots. Maybe the city should use some of these lots for these kinds of events, but could we do it at like 7, 8, or 9 o'clock at night? That way neighbors can get some sleep overnight, crowds can still form, but the streets won't be blocked. However, if the whole point of these street takeovers is indeed to literally take over the street, then this plan might not work. If taking over the street is your goal, well, then we have some other issues we need to work out. And so it goes. On the show this week, speaking of Chicago owning property, we take a deep dive into the upkeep or lack thereof of that property. We learn about a new holiday short film written by a local guy, and we'll talk local music. So stick around and no drag racing on the street, please. Chicago is seeing a serious housing shortage, and it is a problem. The Chicago Housing Authority, also known as the CHA, the government agency responsible for providing safe and affordable homes to those who are low income, has a program that's supposed to help families access new neighborhoods and opportunities. However, this agency has ended up owning vacant and deteriorating properties all over Chicago. A recent story from Block Club Chicago and the Illinois Answers Project brought this issue to light. One of the authors of this piece is our good friend Mick Dumke, reporter at Block Club Chicago. He's also an investigative editor there, and we can check out blockclubchicago.org. Mick, my friend, nice to talk to you again. How are you, man?
I'm doing well, Mike. Always great to be back on the show. So thanks for the invitation.
Of course. And I feel like you've been really rocking the housing land shady deal beat recently. There's just so much to talk about.
Well, it's one of the pressing issues facing our city, Mike. I mean, Chicago's not alone, but it's really pronounced here. There's a housing shortage on a number of different fronts. The city's former housing commissioner said the city's tens of thousands units short of affordable homes, and those are homes, of course, that people just can't find decent, safe housing on the marketplace because rents have gotten so expensive for them. Mm-hmm. And then don't have to tell anybody who's been following the news that we have a steady arrival of people coming from the southern border. Migrants from other countries, and the city's been scrambling to find them places to live. And then, of course, if your eyes are open when you travel around the city or the suburbs, you see tent encampments everywhere. There's a homeless population. So I just feel like it's one of the issues of our time. It's probably one of the issues of all times. But right now, it's really visible and pronounced, our struggles to find proper housing for everybody.
I absolutely agree with you. So tell us about this program that the Chicago Housing Authority has and how this is supposed to give low-income families housing opportunities. What is this program?
Well, it's called the Scattered Site Program, and most people's impressions or images they have of public housing, if they've been around Chicago for a while, is like the old high-rise concentrated developments like Cabrini Green or the Robert Taylor homes. We've talked on your show before about on the Near West Side, the former Abla homes over by UIC. The Scattered Site Program was intended as a totally different type of housing assistance. And it is public housing, but these were meant to be low density properties. Some of them are actually single family homes, and then small apartments or townhomes, that kind of thing. And they're literally scattered around the city. So instead of them being concentrated in one community or in a handful of blocks, like the old high rises were, these properties from the beginning were intended to offer a different kind of housing opportunity for people. People who didn't want to live in those big high rise concentrated developments, who wanted to be in different neighborhoods or living in a different housing situation. So the program, really got started in the 60s, Mike, and it's a fascinating history that is probably worth its own show at some point in time. But for our purposes, this was something that Martin Luther King Jr. encouraged on visits to Chicago. This was something that was actually litigated through years of of courtroom back and forth involving the CHA, and it's the way it was building housing in segregated areas back in the 60s and the times before that. And fast forward to the modern era, it's still supposed to be, a way that the CHA is providing opportunities for people, in a different kind of option. From even now, most of the CHA's properties are in developments where there's quite a few units in one place. The high rises are largely gone, but that's still sort of the model for a lot of CHA's public housing. So the scattered sites are supposed to provide another opportunity. And, when they're done well, you wouldn't even notice them. You're driving down the block, you're walking by, you wouldn't necessarily know that it was a CHA property, that it was public housing. And so, let's face it, there's long been a stigma attached to public housing. So one of the things I think that the scattered sites were supposed to offer was, a way to help people with an essential need, affordable housing, and also remove that stigma and let people access new neighborhoods and potentially new schools, jobs, and that sort of thing.
Right. So not concentrating these public housing units in one area. Like you said, historically, we've seen that in Chicago and the stigma that comes with that. But something that's interesting historically, when you look at, for example, Cabrini Green or Robert Taylor Holmes, the sort of hands-off approach, I guess you could say, or the deterioration of these properties at the hands of the CHA. So let's talk about what you found in this report, because you are reporting on vacant lots that the CHA owns and properties that are left to deteriorate. This is all over Chicago. What exactly did you find here?
Well, I think you're onto something. I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Mike, but we've talked quite a few times through the years. And I think you're noting that, you know, one of the failures of the traditional old developments, the high rises, was that they were not managed or maintained well, and they decayed over time. Mm-hmm. And the literal physical condition of the housing got really poor. And then, of course, the way they were cared for, crime came in. The management, the mismanagement, all those kind of things, you know, eventually led to most of those buildings being razed around the city. So here we have the scattered site option, these homes all over the city that's supposed to be a different kind of housing to help people. And, you know, what we find in the year 2023 is that some of the same trend lines are happening with these properties as we saw in the old CHA properties, namely that there's a lot of units that are sitting empty. We found almost 500 units around the city. One in six of the scattered site properties are sitting vacant. Hmm. And, you know, when no one's living in them most of the time, that means they're not being cared for. People aren't in and out of there. No one's checking the water every day. When properties, no matter who owns them, when properties sit vacant for long periods of time, they tend to deteriorate. So with the CHA sitting on nearly 500 empty units as of earlier this year, you can imagine sort of do the, you know, the multiplication, the math. That's 500 homes sitting around that, first of all, people could use. And second of all, when they're not in use, a lot of them are becoming blights or problems in their communities at the same time. So it becomes kind of a double set of issues with these vacant units.
Yeah, and I think the historical piece is something that we have to keep in mind here. We've seen variations of this in Chicago over the decades, and here we are in 2023 seeing this again. As you report, the city of Chicago has 50,000 people on a list who want a scattered site unit. So there is demand for this, but the city seems to be, I don't know what the city is doing. I mean, they're letting these properties decay. You detail in this report animals, rodents, just awful conditions with mold. So what has the response been from the CHA with all this?
Well, this is one of those stories, Mike, that had an impact even before we published it. So we had been very open with the CHA for months about working on this. You know, my colleagues, Emmeline Posner and Jennifer Bamberg, they went and, you know, approached the CHA earlier this year, months ago, and got data, the numbers that I'm talking about, so that we could get a good overview. We could put this all on a map and see where these properties are. And along the way, we were essentially updating the CHA on what we were finding. We were asking them questions. We didn't wait till the last minute and say, hey, surprise, we've got all this stuff on you. We had been very candid and just very open about it. And so they knew we were working on it. And a good thing happened out of this is that they announced right before we published, they scooped us essentially, Mike. They said, we've found $50 million that we're going to put toward fixing up at least a couple hundred of these properties in the next year or two. And they also said that they were going to sell a handful of properties to people who are currently CHA renters. And so they have a home ownership plan. Let's give the CHA credit where credit is due. They do have a lot of programs, including one where they're trying to move people into opportunities where they can own their own home, so they're not renters anymore. So they said they're going to use, you know, try to help fix up some of these properties and sell them to people who want to own themselves. And then in other cases, they're going to fix up properties. So a couple of them that we highlighted, they said are on these lists. that they're either going to be fixed up or they're going to be sold, you know, to current CHA renters. And, you know, so we counted that as really good news, even if it is kind of a political trick. Just so everybody out there knows how journalism works, you know, I mean, you're working on something, some, in this case, for a long time, we were working on this, and, you know, we want to tell the public about it, but our main goal is to try to, you know, highlight the problem so that it can be fixed. So on the one hand, we have a little bit of rolling of our eyes. I won't say disappointment, but just kind of like a chuckle that the CHA decided to try to, you know, scoop us a little bit by releasing details of this new initiative they just suddenly came up with. But at the same time, we're like ecstatic because whether we ever get any credit for it isn't important. We're just really happy to see that some attention's being paid to this program and some money's being put toward fixing it.
You know, I tend to be the optimist, so I'm going to go half full on this glass here. And I will say, I mean, this is the power of local journalism, right? I mean, you are holding truth to power, right? And you are trying to make sure people are accountable who make these big decisions. But I think, yeah, I get it. The CHA was trying to scoop you a little bit, but they were feeling the heat and you were bringing this spotlight to them. And in my book, I would count that as a win.
Oh, absolutely. It definitely is a win. Now, all that said, you know, our job now is to stay on the story and to make sure that, you know, just because they issued a press release, just because they said, look at what we're going to do. It actually, I think this initiative got passed as part of the CHA's annual budget, which they just approved last week. But, you know, we're not going to take that for granted. We're not just going to assume that they're going to follow through the way they've said. It's on us to stay on the story and to make sure, you know, to see what's happening next and make sure they live up to that. So yeah, I agree, Mike. It is a victory. We take them where we can get them. And, you know, there are people, the CHA, who don't like me very much. There are also people, you know, who I've known for years there, who I really, I think I have a good relationship with. And at the end of the day, none of this is personal. We get that they have difficult jobs, but that is what we do ideally in local news is, you know, report on stuff, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and try to raise questions about issues we discover that just aren't working the way that they should. So in this case, I'll allow you to say it's a win, Mike, and I'll allow myself to feel like, hey, I'm glad we got this out there and some change might be coming, but let's not rest on our laurels. Let's make sure that this stuff actually does get fixed.
That's right. And it is the power of local journalism really on full display here. This piece is wonderful. I mean, it is really detailed, a lot of important and interesting information. It's up at blockclubchicago.org. We will link up to it through all of our channels. And Mick Dumke, reporter and investigative editor at Block Club Chicago. Mick, you're doing some wonderful work over there, you and your colleagues. And thank you for talking to us, as always, about this issue. And I'm sure we'll do it again soon. And happy holidays to you, brother.
Hey, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. And again, I just am grateful for what you do. I am grateful for your interest in this particular story, but in all the stuff that I've done, my colleagues have done, and just I love it, the fact that you keep on doing what you do, Mike, and you tell people, help people discover things about their own city, about their own community, and just makes life a little bit better. So happy holidays to you and to everybody else out there too. Thanks.
We are in the holiday season, and personally, since we don't get snow in December around here anymore, I'm always looking for anything that can bring us all more holiday cheer. So let's turn to YouTube, where we can watch a short film called The Note. It's part of a Christmas series of shorts called The Santa Stories, which again is available on YouTube. This film was written by Kevin Jakubowski, a native of Batavia, Illinois, and a former classmate of mine from Fenwick High School in Oak Park. Kevin Jakubowski, writer, you're back in Illinois. How are you, brother?
I'm great, Mike. It's great to hear your voice, man. Thanks for having me.
You got it. So you were in California. You're back here in Illinois. Got to come back to those Midwest roots. We keep it real here. You know where it's at.
I do, man. My family and I were just so happy to move back to the Tri-Cities and the western suburbs almost a year ago, and we love it, man. I put in 19 years in LA. I did my time.
Wow.
Good to be back. Yeah.
Well, it's great to have you back. So you have had such a really cool career so far, and more is happening. You and I, before we get into the note, we spoke a few years ago about your success with the film that you wrote called 8-Bit Christmas. It was also a book that you wrote. And by the way, we should say it's being shown again this season, tonight, December 16th, a couple days from now, Monday, December 18th, December 23rd, and December 24th on TBS. Neil Patrick Harris is in it. It's a great success. I mean, did you ever think that that would get as big as it actually did?
I don't know. I think you always hope that, you know, I don't know. I think I knew we had something special, and I think it's one of those slow burn kind of things where it was never going to be a big hit right away. But I think it's got enough in it that enough people can relate to that. You know, I'm just really happy and proud of, you know, the fact that TNT and TBS are playing it. You know, it's the lead into a Christmas story. That's like a literal dream come true for me.
Wow.
So it's great. And just the response over the past 2 years of just like more and more people knowing about the movie. And I got a text from somebody yesterday that said, or a couple of days ago, that said they were talking about it on ESPN 1000. I was like, what is happening?
Well, and I'm in the movie too. I'm the first voice, but I just,
yeah,
you know, I just got to drop that in.
First, but I mean, that's the reason everyone loves it, really. They, you know, come for the food, stay for the pie, you know? I mean,
Yep. That's my claim to fame right there. So thank you for letting me ride the coattails of Kevin Jakubowski. So
you were great, Mike.
Appreciate that, brother. So let's talk about this project here, The Note. This, I'm always fascinated, by the way, with kind of a behind the scenes of stuff, especially when it comes to the entertainment industry, because, you know, we never see that side. So this is a short film. And as I understand it, this is presented by Coca-Cola, which is, I think, a small startup company. They've got a bright future. But you wrote this thing. How did this project happen?
Well, it was really interesting. This is a weird year for me and really anybody in the entertainment industry. And, you know, as a writer, I was on strike for, you know, 5 months. You know, I couldn't write TV. I couldn't write feature films. The Writers Guild of America, of which I'm a member, you know, we had to go on strike to be able to continue to keep this a viable, you know, living for people who try to have a middle class living that wasn't attainable anymore under sort of the streaming system. So we had to go on strike for that. And thankfully it worked out. But during that time, I couldn't write on struck work. But this came across my desk as, you know, it's really an advertisement. It's branded content. So it wasn't something where I was scab writing and got it cleared by the guild, and mm-hmm. It was in the waning days of the strike anyway. But I was approached by actually the producer of 8-Bit Christmas, a great guy named Alan Mandelbaum, who now is a producer, an executive at Imagine Entertainment, Ron Howard's company and Brian Grazer's company. And he said that Imagine and Coca-Cola have been doing this thing each year where they produce two or three Christmas shorts. And you know, they're looking for writers, and was I interested? And you know, I grew up on those Coca-Cola Christmas commercials. They're
sure.
So iconic, and just, you know, they make you feel good, Mike, you know.
I know.
And so I said sure. And so I put together a few ideas, and there were other writers putting together ideas, and they liked one of them and hired me to write the script. And then mine was one of the two scripts that was chosen to get shot. So that's kind of how it came together. And then I was fortunate enough to get into my contract that they had to send me to Ireland to make it. And so I got to go there, and was fortunate enough to have Bryce Dallas Howard directed, who did a wonderful job, and her team. She has a company called Nine Muses Entertainment, and we shot it over there. It was a quick shoot in 3 days, but it was a ton of fun, and I think it really turned out really well.
The name of the short film is The Note, and it is part of a series of short films presented by Coca-Cola called The Santa Stories. And we can go onto YouTube and search for The Santa Stories to find this film. Directed by Bryce Dallas Howard, she's a great actress, and she's been doing just awesome work directing. I mean, I think she was doing episodes of The Mandalorian. She was in the Star Wars universe. So that is, yeah, that's quite the get there.
Yeah, it was really exciting. She read the treatment and just kind of fell in love with it. She told me that she cried after she read it.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was great to see her work and just learn from her and be able to collaborate with her. And she did a great documentary that I really love called Dads. If people get a chance to check that out, it's really good, which I really liked as well. So it's been great, and we're working on something else right now. So,
wow.
It's been a great collaboration so far.
That's super cool. So you went to Ireland, you shot this. Now the plot of this, we don't want to give it away, but just generally speaking, it's about a gentleman, and he doesn't talk too much. So
right,
he's
right.
Kind of like the Bah Humbug guy around Christmas.
He is. Yeah. It's set, and it was supposed to be set in the Aran Islands off the west coast of Ireland, but we couldn't really get into specifics with that. But it's about an old fisherman who comes across this message in a bottle, and almost it's like destiny that he, whatever this message says, he has to figure out if he's going to comply with it or not. And it's about, you know, how really giving can mend a broken heart, and how the act of giving, the giver, him or herself, can be healed through the act of giving. You know, it's not always the recipient that's healed. It's the giver himself. And so that's really what it's about. And I think that's a really good message for Christmas. And that's kind of the point of Christmas. And so, it was really fun to do it. I had gone to graduate school in Ireland, so I knew Ireland pretty well. And so I decided to set it there. But that made it kind of unique, and it was just fun to be able to go back. And funny story, Mike, a good buddy of mine who was an actor who was in my first short film that I ever directed 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
His name's Rian Shee Kelly. He's an actor in LA. He was in Ireland at the time just randomly because he's from Dublin and was just back visiting his folks. And I was like, you should audition for this. You'd be great. And he plays the role of the clerk in it. So we hadn't worked together in 20 years, and we were able to work together on this. So it's just a wonderful kind of thing to happen.
That's so cool. And yes, this film will get you a little misty eyed. It tugs at the heartstrings. It's one of those, and it's beautifully shot. It looks great. And I have to say this, the fisherman, the older fisherman, played by my guy, Colm Meaney, who is a wonderful actor who's been in a million things, and I love Star Trek. He will always be Chief O'Brien to me. So when I saw Chief O'Brien, and I say that in a positive way, respectful way to Colm Meaney, I'm like, dude, I'm in. So you got to work with him too.
It was great. He's always been one of my favorite actors. I'm a huge fan of the author and screenwriter, Roddy Doyle. So he has this, he wrote, they're not as familiar to people over here, but he wrote The Commitments and The Snapper and The Van. And Roddy, Colm Meaney plays the dad and all those. And he's just great. So he's he's almost as famous as Colin Farrell is in Ireland, as far as the Irish are concerned. So it was just really cool to get to know him a bit. And he was great and just funny. And it was fun to hang out with him and talk to him. And he was great. And what a great dog, too, huh? The dog.
The dog. Yeah, I mean, everyone in this film, down to the dog, is just, it really is fantastic. We should all check out The Note. Kev, before I let you go, because I know you're a busy writer with a lot of things going on and celebrities and agents calling, you went through, like you said, this writer's strike, and that was a lot for you. You said it was 5 months, but I mean, where things are at now, are you satisfied with that? It sounds like you are, but I mean, today we're living in this world of AI, and it seems like we can take a lot of these things for granted in terms of the stuff you don't see necessarily behind the scenes. Are you satisfied where things are now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a ways to go, and it was just a starting point in terms of what needs to be ratified. You know, it's a little complicated, but at the end of the day, for 50 years, there was a business model that worked for everyone, you know, that worked for, you know, if you wrote on a TV series, you know, for a while, you know, you could buy a house in LA. You could send your kids to college, and that's just not possible anymore. You can't do that. You have to have created multiple shows to be, you know, I mean, I moved to Illinois because I couldn't buy a house in California. So those things have been stripped away because of the streaming model, this new business model where we're not paid per every time something that we wrote airs. You know, it's a watered down sort of business model that really doesn't pay any residuals. And that's what writers need to survive. So that was mended a bit. And then the AI of it all is just as important. You know, I mean, we watch movies for the human connection. If you remove that, what are you doing?
Right.
So it was really important to fix that, or at least get some language in it that said, you know, movies need to be written by humans. I don't think that's that difficult to have in a contract. So, right. But it took 5 months for them to say, okay, you know, that's one thing that I will say about the Writers Guild of America. Don't mess with them, man. It's a lot of really smart people that are used to getting pushed around. And that's not a good combo for the other side. So, you know, we stuck together, and we got to hand it to the actors too. They stuck together. And I think we got a business model that can work for everybody. You know, it's not like we're making bad entertainment. I mean, the U.S. arguably creates the best film and TV in the world, and it's one of our favorite products. And so to not be paying the people that create your only product, Netflix, doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear that, man. Well, I'm glad that this worked out for you. And, you know, speaking of human connection, The Note, definitely that humanity comes through. We should all check out The Note. It is on YouTube, so you can just search for The Note on YouTube or search for our guy, Colm Meaney. He rules. We'll link up to this short film. It is written by Batavia native Kevin Jakubowski, who is a writer. He's back here in Illinois, and he's just doing so much. Hey, buddy, it's always so much fun talking with you, and I'm just so happy for you, man. All this success, it's a hard business. I know this is a hard business, but you're doing it. You're doing great at it. So congratulations, man, and happy holidays to you.
Thanks, Mike. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, buddy.
You got it. We should all check out The Note on YouTube. It is very, very good.
Also, Mike, sorry, it's on Amazon Prime. If you want to,
and Amazon Prime, why not? You know,
get it in there. Give Amazon needs the views, you know?
Yeah, right.
They kick Amazon a bone. Yeah. You know, I think they're hurting.
You could go buy a set of knives and a blender and then switch over and watch on Amazon Prime and get it all delivered to your house. Brother, congrats, man.
Thanks, Mike. Thank you.
Let's talk local music right now from the band Skip Class and the Dropouts. Their debut EP called Orientation is coming out in January. And with us to chat about this band is Danny Jacobson. He is the lead singer of the band Skip Class and the Dropouts. Danny, welcome to Outside the Loop.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate being here.
You bet. So a lot happening with this band, and you guys are, I don't want to say new, but you kind of are. I mean, you're relatively new. You've been playing a while, but this group, Skip Class and the Dropouts, is kind of a new-ish band, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. All the guys in the band have definitely been around the block. We've done a lot of different stuff. We're all in separate projects. We all have a bunch of different, you know, bands we're all in, including a different cover band where we've kind of performed all around the city. But yeah, Skip Class and the Dropouts as its own entity is definitely new. I guess it's really, it's like less than a year old. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't even have a website yet. And that's okay, by the way. I'm not like shaming you, like get a website. You know, but you've got your Instagram. So you should just search, go on Instagram, search for Skip Class and the Dropouts. And you're the only one.
We are. It's a pretty unique name. And that's part of the reason why we chose it. So.
Yeah, no, I like it. So let's talk about your tunes. I mean, as you say here, you're a mixture of pop, funk, soul, and disco. And I think that's interesting because when you call that out and you listen to your music, I think there are elements where you're like, yeah, right there, there's the disco beat, or there's the funky part or the soul. So, I mean, this is really kind of an eclectic mix. I mean, you are bringing in influences from all over the place, it seems.
Yeah, definitely. I'm the lead songwriter, but each guy in the band comes with their own parts, and that's what kind of makes everything really different. Some of the guys are certainly coming from more of a rock background, and some of us are coming from more of like a pop kind of let's have fun sort of, you know, which brings in the disco. I like a lot of soul and funk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you kind of mix that all together, you get Skip Class and the Dropouts.
This is, I think, a cool combination because all those genres, I mean, I think there's so many great positive things you could say about all of those genres of music, and now you're combining them all here.
Right.
So in terms of the tunes here, you've got your first EP. It's called Orientation. It's coming out in January. Tell us about what's going on with this new recorded stuff, your first recorded sort of outing here.
Yeah. So the EP is going to be, it's four songs. And each one is a little different. So we have X2, which is definitely kind of like a pop, fun, total surface level kind of love song that I feel like most people can, it's just really easy to listen to. And then Sauce, which is sort of our single. And that one's definitely along the same lines. It's just, hey, we're on the dance floor. It's kind of the disco, you know, one that gets everyone going. And then we have Million Pieces, which is a little bit more heavy and definitely where the soul kind of comes in. We recently added a keyboard, and he's amazing. And so he kind of gave us the little soul funky flavor that we needed. And then we have Girls Just Want to Dance, which is definitely also kind of fun.
When I get down at the bottom, you hit me up the perfect recipe. Yeah, you flirt with California, but sleep with Arizona. Yeah, I wanna pull you closer. You got a sweet aroma. I could love
what you said there. It's fun. This is a good time. It's a lot of fun to listen to. And so you have this new music. Again, this is coming out in January. So we can stream this, I'm assuming, where, you know, because we live in the future. Anywhere we stream our music in January, we can get this new EP.
Yeah, we're going to obviously, you know, do the main release on Spotify and everywhere that you can listen to music, Apple Music, iTunes, all that stuff. Right now, you can actually go to our SoundCloud, which is also Skip Class and the Dropouts. And we have that stuff up right now, I think, on public. So anyone can, you know, like you said, in the future, you can listen to the EP now, but we're going to set the release for sometime in January. We don't have the exact date yet, but yeah, if you want to check it out, it's on there.
This is the first series of recorded songs, officially produced and recorded songs, but you have been playing some gigs. So you've been playing around Chicago a little bit as Skip Class and the Dropouts.
We actually had like our very first show at a venue called Evanston Space, sure, which it's here in Evanston where I'm based actually. And there's been a lot of really actually pretty big bands and acts who've come in and out of here. So it was an honor to do a show there. And that was just kind of like a preliminary kind of really casual thing. And then we're putting together something actually March 28th at Cole's Bar in Logan Square with a few other bands. So that's going to be a lot of fun, and that might end up being our EP release party. We're not sure yet, but the date is definitely set. So we're doing that. But yeah, as far as like a bunch of other cover gigs and stuff, we've been performing with the four or five of us, just different iterations around town for really like a year or so now. But yeah, as far as Skip Class goes, we're still pretty new and everything, so this might only be our second show.
How about that? Well, you know, it's interesting playing around Chicago, and I know that you have for a while now in other iterations of bands.
Right.
But the whole cover thing, I mean, I don't know. I feel like there was a period there where people were like, oh, cover bands. But now, I don't know, maybe I'm getting older, but I'm like, you know what? Look, these are songs that are... they're tested, right? They're audience right. tested. We know that these are good tunes. Here's your interpretation. I mean, that's such a fun thing. How's that been playing the cover stuff going around Chicago?
Honestly, I you know, it as a songwriter, it kind of hurts my soul a little bit to be playing other people's songs.
Yeah,
I'm not going to lie. I mean, that's just total, you know, full stop. But at the same time, though, you just have to be realistic. And when you're a songwriter and people don't really know your songs, they're just, you know, even if they're like, okay, this is a good groove, I'm gonna dance because I like this, and maybe by the second chorus, if it's catchy enough, they sing along, which is great, it's a great feeling. But you still have to throw in the songs that people know and love, and we play a lot, you know, from decade to decade and genre to genre. And when someone hears My Girl or, you know, All Star by Smash Mouth, even it's, you know, in all its cheesiness,
yeah,
people get up and they love it. You know what? It still feels good to play that stuff. And we do our own versions of it and we jam them out. And, you know, we have a lot of fun with it. We don't play it exactly the way the covers ever are. We always switch things up.
Sure. And that's part of the fun of it, I think. And that could be yeah. really cool. And I can't remember who told me this. Somebody I interviewed a little while ago said, local musician said, you know what I do when I'm playing a solo acoustic gig? I'll start with like two covers and people are like, yeah, okay, sweet. And they're kind of in. And then I start playing my stuff and I kind of have them hooked, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, maybe yeah. there's a little bit of that. You slide in some covers and then maybe get in, I don't know, you can get in a couple of tracks maybe at some point. And the cover songs are a nice hook, I guess, is what I'm trying to say here.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, he's right. Well, you know, when we play some of those cover gigs, we'll do, I'll actually start with originals. And then I'm like, okay, if we don't have them hooked yet, then we throw in a few covers and then we'll throw in another few originals. And that's just kind of the way we do it. But it's definitely, you know, if your originals are good enough and they sound enough like they could be covers, I think people just think that they're obscure covers that they don't know, and they're like, oh, I should be dancing to this. This is, you know, this, do you know this song? No, okay, but whatever, you know, it's good, it's catchy, it's got a nice groove, so we're dancing. So I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of how it is. I mean, we've had shows where we played like mostly originals and people were feeling it, and then we had some old lady come up to us and was like, you gotta play stuff people know. And so as mad as I was for a few minutes, I was like, you know what, she's right, we're at like, you know, Taste of Highwood or something. We got to play songs people know. So,
yeah,
you know, well, that's how it goes.
Well, that's show business, right? That's how it goes.
It is.
And we should all check out Skip Class and the Dropouts on Instagram. Just search for that band, Skip Class and the Dropouts. Look for the new EP called Orientation coming out in January and some gigs to follow in the new year. Danny Jacobson is the lead singer of the band Skip Class and the Dropouts. Hey, Danny, thanks for talking to us today. Your music sounds wonderful. Good luck with everything going forward, man.
Thanks, man. You too. And again, I appreciate you having me on here. It's a great show, and I wanted to give a shout out to all the rest of the guys in the band. They keep it going. So, you know, hopefully you'll see us March 28th at Cole's Bar in Logan Square. We'll be there playing.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 896 is done. I say thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Boy, you're fantastic. Thanks to Bob Fukuda for all of his engineering help today. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.